What we're going to do tonight, folks, is we're going to spend... I got my philosophy binder here. We're going to spend some time. Now, I gave you the handout on Socrates, and I just noticed tonight that the bottoms of this first page, first and second page, got cropped out. There's more writing down here at the bottom. And there's a button on our... See how it says graphy on the top? It's supposed to say biography. So some of this got cut out, and the numbers that went along the side got cut out. So when I put the transparencies up here, you can take a look at it, and if you have to jot anything else in, you can do it.
That's the only page, the first top page?
Just the first, yeah, page one and page two.
Will I be lost without those handouts?
No, because we're going to put it all up on the board, and I'll give it to you during the break. Yeah, I'll give it to you during the break. Okay, I'm going to put it up on the transparency here so you can see it. Okay, now listen, Socrates, you don't have to know anything about philosophy to have heard that name, right? Who was Socrates? Socrates was an obnoxious, arrogant, hated bug. He was a bugger. You know what a bugger? You say, "Oh, you little bugger." You know, you have one of these kids runs right over your toe and then they laugh on the way to the bathroom. You say, "Oh, you little bugger." He was a bugger. He would go up to people and make them look stupid in front of an audience. He had disciples that walked around with him, and they would come, and Socrates would come up, and he would say something like, "How you doing?" And you'd say, "All right, how you doing?" And now all of a sudden, you've got a little half circle around you, and they're listening, and you're saying, "Hey, I didn't ask for this. What is happening here?" And I say, "Let me ask you a question. What is justice?" And you say, "Well, justice is paying every man back what you owe him." And Socrates says, "Okay, so if you owed a man a weapon, and in the time that you borrowed that weapon, the man became insane, and if you gave him back that weapon knowing that he would probably hurt himself with it, would that be a just thing to do?" And you go, "No." And now you look stupid. You go, no, probably not. "Oh, okay, so maybe that's not justice then, huh?" Now listen, folks. This is called the Socratic method. Can you see why this guy had more enemies than he could shake a stick at? He went, listen to this now. Socrates would go about, this was his living. You know, it's really funny because Xenophanes was also one of his followers, and Xenophanes is a guy who wrote a lot about Socrates. Socrates, very important, wrote nothing. And there's a question on the test that Socrates wrote the apology, and he did not. The apology was written by Plato. We'll talk about that later, what the apology is. But Socrates never wrote anything. All that we know about Socrates comes from the writing of his star pupil, Plato, and Xenophanes. Xenophanes writes Socrates had a wife called Xanthippe. And Xanthippe goes down in history, folks, as being the biggest, most difficult, nagging wife in the history of the world. And I remember, he would come in and she would lambaste him. "You no good bum, rah, 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 rah." And you read it and you say, boy, you know, you're reading these histories and you're saying, poor Socrates, you know. And then one day, I'm sitting there and I reading this, I stop thinking and I'm saying, you know what? Socrates never took any money from anybody. Never took any money for teaching them, supposedly. He's a teacher, right? But unlike the Sophists the Sophists were groups of traveling teachers. They were teachers that would walk along, and they held a philosophy known as, does anyone remember from last time? Relativism. Remember the other guys that said, Heraclitus said, all things are in a constant state of flux. Parmenides said, nothing ever changes. They both came to their conclusion through reason. Therefore, reason, nobody can know what the truth is by reason. So they said, whatever you think is good. Relativism. If you think it's good, Paul, then it's good. If it's good for you, Ginger, then it's good. But you can't tell me, how can you tell me what the truth is or that I'm wrong? When we can't come up with the truth through reason. You can't tell me. I came to my conclusions by thinking them out. You came to yours by thinking them out. So what makes your thinking any more valid than mine? See the idea? Okay? No truth. No objective truth. No word of God. You get away from the word of God and we've got problems, right? Okay. So, but I'm thinking about this, and Xanthippe is, I mean, she's, she's unbelievable. You read these accounts and you say, gosh, how in the world did Socrates ever put up with this woman? And then I started thinking, what would your life be like, ladies, if you were married to a guy that basically never washed up, and I'm sorry, never washed up, okay? Walked around in shabby clothes all the time in the dusty Greek towns, was impervious to any kind of heat or cold. He would wear the same clothes whether it was 90 degrees out or whether it was 10 below zero. I mean, the guy was supposedly impervious to the weather. Didn't bother him at all. Never took any money. Never brought any money at all into the house. Now we've got to live. Never took any money into the house, and he would get up in the morning and he would say, well, honey, I gotta go. Where are you going? I'm going to work. What are you doing? I'm going down into the agora, the marketplace, and I'm going to harass people and show them how stupid they are so that they may come to enlightenment. But the thing is, so when I started reading it, I started to get a little sympathetic towards old Xanthippe, and I think maybe she's got a bum rap. I don't think any woman could put up with that. I know my wife couldn't. I mean, listen, he is what you would call in the modern day a deadbeat. He basically just went, from place to place banging around. All right, let's go through this biography stuff really quickly. He's perhaps the most famous philosopher of all time. He's the son of a stonemason and a midwife around 469 BC, good, almost 500 years before Christ. His entire life is spent around Athens. He served in the military for a time and in the government. He excelled in both. He was absolutely brilliant. Quote, he was a rather homely man in a society that prized manly beauty, and though he was hardly poor, he seems to have managed on much less money than his friends and disciples had. Here's the problem, one of the things that gets him in big trouble. You know these guys who are following him around? They're all rich. You know why they're all rich? Can anybody tell me why all the people who are following him around would be rich? No.
They had all the time.
What's that?
They had the time.
They had the time. Listen, you're not going to get Joe Turnipicker following this guy around. He's going to starve to death. But you get the aristocrats, and the aristocrats are following him around. And all of a sudden, he begins to gain a reputation by the people that are being humiliated by him. He begins to gain a reputation as someone who speaks for the upper classes and tries to drive a wedge between the classes. He degrades the craftsman. He degrades the farmer. He doesn't really do this. Now, you have to understand, Socrates is true to his own principles. He believes that he's doing good, okay? The capstone of all of Socrates' philosophy is this. The truth is within you. The truth is within you. The answers to any question that I have are within you. But those questions need to be brought out. And by the way, you know the word education, educare in the Latin? It's a word educare, and it means to bring forth, to bring out, to reveal. And it comes from this concept of Socrates, that the truth is within and it needs to be brought out into the open. Now, Socrates believes that I cannot teach you anything. In Socrates' concept, I'm standing here right now, and the way we think of it anyway is we go to a class because supposedly the instructor knows something about some subject that we don't know much about and we want to learn. So the instructor stands up at the podium, or the pastor stands up at the podium and imparts knowledge, or in the case of a pastor, imparts the life of Christ, which is a much higher form of knowledge because it becomes experiential in our lives. But the thing is this, the instructor stands up and imparts knowledge. Not according to Socrates. I cannot impart any information to you that you do not already know. All I can do is help you to bring that information out. Now, this is the Socratic method, what is known as the Socratic method. His method of bringing the truth out of people. This is how he did it, through interrogation. Dialogue. He would dialogue with them. He would ask questions like, Steve, what is justice? And Steve would answer. And then he would show with some clever argument why Steve did not have the whole answer there. And so Steve would say, okay, then maybe justice is this. And through this dialogue, back and forth, the truth would come out. Get the idea? And Socrates would say, I am not educating that person. I never told him what justice is. He told himself what it is. You see the idea? That's the Socratic method. Okay. Where he's rather a homely man. Remember, Athens is very aesthetic. They're looking for beauty. They're looking for perfection in sculpture, and they really prize this kind of a physical beauty. But he's rather an ugly guy, and nobody knows where he got his money. Nobody knows where he got his money. Probably Xanthippe did some work she didn't have to do around around Athens, cleaning up and stuff. He is said to always have been dressed in shabby clothes. He went barefoot wherever he went. His indifference to heat and cold, hunger and thirst amazed anyone. He was one of the. He's called the secular Christ. He is called the secular Christ for the reason that he's going to die for his philosophical beliefs, as a martyr to all those who believe that the truth is within and you can say what you want. Okay. In his day, Athens was a prosperous city, about 130,000 citizens. Although it was large for its time, it was still small enough to be personal and intimate. Everybody basically knew one another. Wolf continues, Socrates developed the practice of going into squares and meeting places of Athens to cajole, goad, and draw his fellow townsmen into discussions about how men ought to live their lives. Socrates was quick-witted, clever, and tenacious. He had a knack for asking hard and embarrassing questions that forced others to think a good deal more than they really wanted to. You know what? Whenever you get somebody thinking more than they really want to, you've got some problems. And he says, because some of the people he quizzed were important politicians and famous teachers, it was fun to watch him trip them up, as long as you weren't one of those who were made to look foolish. See, if you were one of the aristocrats watching this, you're saying, boy, Socrates is brilliant. You see how he laid into that guy? But the guy that he lays into has a whole different approach to the situation, doesn't he? And when Socrates is on trial, you know what he says? He says, you know what? He says, there are Miletus, Lytos, and Anytos. The three guys who bring charges against him. They bring him to court. They drag Socrates into court and they say, this guy is guilty of two things. Number one, he is guilty of impiety. He's disregarded the gods of the Greeks. He's an atheist. They don't say that at first, but he's an atheist. Secondly, he's corrupting the youth of Athens. How's he doing that? How is he corrupting the youth of Athens? Or how would they say that he is?
What he's preaching to the people.
What he's preaching, but the disciples that are following him, right, are young men like Plato, brilliant young men who have money and time to burn. And what is he doing? Rather than getting them occupied with things that are useful to society, to the polis, what is he doing? He's teaching them how to win debates about anything, whether right or wrong. That's the accusation. You don't care about truth, Socrates. You're teaching them how to argue. How to win debates, right or wrong. Well, okay. Well, oh, hey, listen to this. You know, this is so funny. Because, I'll show you. In the, I make my students read the Apology in philosophy class in 12th grade philosophy. Plato's Apology is the defense trial of Socrates. It is Socrates, the defense that he gave of himself before the jury. And it is absolutely brilliant. I mean, you know what's funny though? It's brilliantly written and it's from an eyewitness, because Plato was an eyewitness to the trial. What's unbelievable about it is, anyone remember Watergate? Remember Watergate? What was that guy's name? That the country lawyer there? What is his name? Remember the guy that used to come in and he used to be like, well, remember him? Yeah. Well, we're going to do the best we can to win this trial, and you know, we don't want to get all wrapped up in the technical things, we're just kind of getting to the truth. And he comes across like I'm just a good old stupid dumb country lawyer bumpkin. This guy was a brilliant, brilliant defense attorney. Absolutely comes across, yeah, well, you know, we're going in there. We're looking for the truth. I ain't much for fancy book learning and stuff, but we're that kind of stuff. And this guy was absolutely brilliant. Well, Socrates does the same thing. And I'll tell you what. I'm going to show you tonight that this guy's integrity was lacking in the apology. He's always talking about integrity and stuff, but you know what he does? Paul Miletus, and he's so easy because he's a religious fanatic. Miletus is a religious fanatic, well known in his time, and Socrates wasn't the first guy he brought to court. Socrates won't be the last guy he brought to court. He's always bringing people to court for impiety, for dishonoring the gods. He was a religious fanatic. And Socrates, Socrates is always talking about the gods in some way or another, but he is not accepting the gods the way that traditionally they've been accepted, okay? And what he does, which is very unfair to Paul Miletus, he gets him all worked up. If you ever get the chance to read it, it's not very long, read it. As a matter of fact, I would even let you borrow it if you wanted to just borrow it and read it. But here's what he says. He says, so Miletus, what are you trying to say then? No, come on, stand up so that everyone can hear you. Now the jury is 500, there is no judge in the sense of a modern day courtroom. It's 501 Athenians on a jury. And they're going to vote, and however the vote comes out, that's whether he's guilty or whether he's innocent. Okay? That's how they did it. And this was a sub-court of a 6,000-man court, which was elected by lot. That's the way they did it in democratic Athens. Now, Socrates says, okay, I've been accused of a lot of things here today. He goes, now listen, please, I'm going to talk to you. I'm not a lawyer, he says. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not much for fancy book learning and stuff. I don't know all of the terminology. He goes, I'm a foreigner to this courtroom. He says, so please, if I sound stupid, if my words are, you know, not appropriate for the courtroom, please think of me as a foreigner. I'm not here to give you clever words and all this. And then he proceeds to give an absolutely textbook, brilliant defense of himself. The only reason Socrates died was because he alienated the jury so much that they were so angry at him by the time the trial was done. You know what he does? I'll tell you what he does. At one point in the trial, he says, you know what? I'm not on trial. You are. And he says, he goes, I've done nothing wrong, and you're in danger of doing something much greater than I ever could have done, because you are all in danger of making yourself lesser people. You're going to do evil unto yourself by convicting an innocent man of doing nothing. And all of us, they don't like that. You know what I mean? They're like, who does this guy think he is? Then when he's found guilty, folks, oh boy, I'm letting the cat out of the bag early here, but I got to tell you, when he's found guilty, here's the way the procedure goes. When he's found guilty in Athens, what they do is, he is found guilty. Now the sentencing comes. And the sentencing comes this way, where Miletus, Anytos, and Lytos will stand up there, and they will propose a sentence. I propose that Socrates, for impiety and corrupting the youth, receive the death sentence. Guy sits down. Now Socrates gets up. His job is to offer a alternative sentence, okay? And then the jury decides which one is most appropriate. Socrates says, this is the way I look at it. If somebody wins the Olympics, he says they give him a year of room and board at the most expensive hotel, basically, is what it boils down to, in Athens, for a whole year, because he's a national hero. He goes, seeing as how I've never done anything wrong, and all I've ever done is serve Athens, I propose as my penalty free room and board for life in that place. Now, at this point, folks, listen, he hangs himself because he alienated the jury so much that they found him guilty in the first place. Guilty of, the guy really didn't do anything except he was obnoxious and he made a lot of enemies. Now, we studied this. I mean, it took us 2 weeks to get through this thing because we studied it word for word and really broke down his arguments in this thing. But you know what he does? It's really something. He says, when he comes out, he goes, you know what? I have two sets of accusers here today. Anytos, Miletus, and Lycon, those guys are easy. He goes, they will not find me guilty. He goes, they're a piece of cake. But I have another set of accusers. And you know what that is? That is the collective opinion that you've heard all your life about Socrates. When your daddy sat you on your knee, you heard about a troublemaker who goes around and talks to people and makes trouble and makes people look stupid. And he says, you know what? He says, that is the set of accusers that's going to find me guilty tonight. And you know what? It is. Fanaticism means, the best definition I've ever heard, is zeal without knowledge. They have zeal without knowledge. A zealot. You know, they have zeal but no knowledge behind it. And those are dangerous people. Okay? Those are the Jim Jones kind of people. Now watch this. Miletus is a religious fanatic. And so Socrates exploits the poor guy, and he says, "Get up, Miletus. Now you've laid some pretty heavy charges against me." He goes, "Tell me, what are you trying to say?" "Oh, I'm trying to say that you don't follow the gods." "Oh, so I don't follow the gods like I should, huh? So what are you trying to, come on, Miletus, what are you talking, well, you don't go to the festivals like you, so I don't go to the festivals. What are you trying to say? Are you calling me an atheist?" And he goes, "Yes, you're an atheist." Oh, now that's the problem. He is not an atheist. And it's very easy to prove he's not an atheist. But Miletus never charged him of being an atheist. He got him all worked up in a frenzy. And then he said, he got him to emotionally say, "You're an atheist." And then Socrates goes on to prove categorically that he is not an atheist and makes Miletus look stupid. And it's done. You see what I mean? But you listen, it's one of the most dishonest forms of logic. When one of the classic techniques in debating is, if you're cornered against a wall, you create an argument which doesn't exist and then defend it. You see what I mean? He created an argument that didn't exist, and then he proved he was right, and meanwhile everybody's saying, "Hey, you know what, he proved he's right." But all the time nobody stopped and said, "Hey, yeah, but he was never accused of that. He's here for impiety and he's here for corrupting the youth of Athens. He was never accused of being an atheist." You see, but as soon as Miletus accused him of it in trial, that's it. Now he has the right to defend it, and when he does, he makes Miletus look like a fool. Then they talked about, then here's what else he does to this poor bird. He gets up and he says, they're putting him down for being a teacher, and they say that he's corrupting the youth of Athens, you know, by being a teacher to these men, and they're following him all around and everything. He goes, "Okay, let me ask you a question then." He says, "If that's the case," he said, who is a good man?" And the guy says, this is what the guy answers. He says, "The jury members." He says, "Who is good? Who is good and who is able to instruct these men?" And he goes, "The jury members." And Socrates goes, "Oh, okay, so the jury, 501, and all of them are virtuous and able to instruct the other men in virtue." "Yes." And he thinks he's got them. Then he says, "Okay. And what about the officials in the town, the government? What about the, oh yes, they too. They're virtuous. Those are the men, those men are good and virtuous men, and they are able to instruct the youth and not corrupt them." "Oh, okay. What about the craftsmen that go to work every day and work hard for a living? Are they?" "Oh yes, they too. Those are good men. Those men can teach." So what he does is he's thinking names every category of people that exist in Athens. And this bird says, "Yeah, oh, they're virtuous," because he doesn't want to offend anybody. And Socrates says, "You know what? That doesn't make any sense now, does it?" He says, "I am the only one in Athens who's not virtuous." He says, "I'm the only guy who's not." He goes, "Now let me ask you a question." He goes, "Is that the way it really goes in nature?" He goes, "Now this is how brilliant Socrates is, as far as logic and arguing." He says, "Let me ask you this question. If you have a horse, what would you do if you want to train that horse? Would you put that horse in the public arena and let everybody train that horse? Or would you get a professional horse trainer? Who would be most qualified to train the horse? The one or the many who have never trained a horse?" "Well, what does Paul Miletus look like? An imbecile." And so you see, he goes on, and, "But you know, I'm not much for fancy book learning. And if I sound stupid, don't hold it against me," because he goes, I'm going to speak to you like I speak to the people in the agora, in the marketplace. And that's exactly what he does. And you know how he spoke to people in the marketplace? He made them look foolish. So this is what Socrates is all about. Now, let's move on. I've already covered most of my preliminary notes here. Let me just get to a couple of things. I've already covered all of this. Well, yeah, we don't need to get into that. There's a couple of really good... There's a couple of really good, this paper on Socrates is really good. Take the time to read it. There's a lot of good information there. One thing that's really amazing about him is why he dies. People have tried to come up with reasons for why he dies. Now, the thing about Socrates is he could have escaped at any time. He was given a very easy, you know what he basically had to do? All Socrates had to do is say, I will pay, you know, $20, you know, for my crimes. I propose a sentence of $20, a parking fee. And you know what? He would have probably gotten off. The jury did not want to convict Socrates of death, but convict him to death. But listen to this. They had a choice. Either they find him guilty and they sentence him to the death penalty, or they give him room and board for life at the expense of Athens. You see what I'm saying? The man hung himself. So then he's in the, you got to read the Crito. And these are four dialogues by Plato, okay? The dialogue, these are the trial and the death of Socrates. Euthyphro, the Crito, the Phaedo, and the Apology are all in here. And what it is they record his last days in prison. You know, Plato was with him and he wrote them down. He wrote them as dialogues. This is the way that Plato wrote. He wrote in dialogue. He wrote, it's almost like reading a play. Two people will be walking down the street and, you know, and often Socrates is one of the characters in the dialogue. Two people will be walking down the street and Socrates will say, "What is justice?" And on it goes. That is actually what happens in the Republic. That very argument, "What is justice?" That's how this is his longest dialogue. It's not a book, it's a dialogue. The Republic is a long dialogue. What is the perfect state? What is it like? What is it about? What would the perfect state be like? Okay, so let me say a couple more things here. And then we'll try to wrap Socrates up. Very interesting guy, is he not? Now he dies, he drinks hemlock, which is poison. Never had to drink it. Never had to drink it whatsoever. He could have escaped. His friends tried to get him to just leave. All he had to do was leave Athens. That would have been the end of it. All he had to do was propose a decent penalty for himself that would have appeased the jury in that. But he said, "I've done nothing wrong. I deserve a reward, not a penalty." So he could have got off very easily, but he did not choose to do that. He chose to die instead for his virtue. Okay, supposedly, which I think is lacking anyway, the secular Christ. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, when you read the Apology and you really put it under a microscope, you learn that this guy's integrity is not what he claims it is. Okay, he is, another thing he's charged with, though, is not honoring the gods. Now, this is an important thing. How do the Greeks know about the gods? Who knows? What's the Greek Bible? The Iliad and the Odyssey. Homer's two epic length poems. These are supposed, you know, they're tales of Agamemnon and Achilles and all the guy with the heel, you know. Achilles and all these guys and Odysseus and the battle, the fall of Troy, you know, and the battle of Troy and all of this, okay? Now, however, in the Iliad, Homer, which is, by the way, your homework for tonight. I hate to even say that we have an exam next time, but if you get a chance, I'm sure you all will. But the chapter in the book on Homer, if you would read that, and actually there were two chapters I wanted you to read. I'm almost afraid to say that, but do what you can. It's on the sheet. I have a syllabus sheet for tonight. Yeah, here it is. Yeah, the chapters 4 and 5, Homer and the Polis. Now, Homer is their Bible, and to say something against Homer, folks, is actually to say something against the gods. And we're going to see in our next session, what these guys think of the poets and why. And this is what gets him into so much trouble. Let me explain it to you. He says, in the Apology, Socrates, in his defense, here's what he said. He said, the Oracle of Delphi, we're all familiar with the Oracle of Delphi, He said, one day someone went to the Oracle of Delphi, and they said, they asked the Oracle this question, who is the wisest man on the earth? And Socrates, the Oracle came back and said, there is none wiser in all the earth than Socrates. Now, he comes back, and Socrates actually had this guy's brother. The guy was dead now, but he had his brother in court, and he goes, he will attest to you that this is what the Oracle told him. He said, now listen, I thought it was my duty. When I heard this, I said, this is ridiculous. What, I am the wisest man in a... He goes, no, I have no wisdom. I'm not wise at all. And because the God... wise at all. And because the god Apollo said that I am the wisest man in all of the world, I felt it was my mission in life to prove the god correct. Listen, God said that. You want to hear what God said about me? Ask him. I have nothing. Now listen, number one, does that sound like impiety? Does that sound like he's not believing the gods? No. He's making his whole defense that I am on a mission for God. God said I was the wisest man in the world. Now, you see how brilliant this is? The man was absolutely brilliant when it comes to this. So he says this. Now, so what did I do? I tried to find out what was wisdom. I had to find out, what do the gods mean by this, calling me the wisest man in all the world? I had to find out, what do they mean by this wisdom? So I went. And first I went to, of course, who? The poets. I went to the poets, and I said, I inquired to them what wisdom was. I asked them about their poems, and he goes, you know what I found out? He said, although they write from some kind of inspiration, and that's how he puts it in the apology, that's why I say it that way, although they write by some kind of inspiration, when I quiz them about what their words mean, they themselves do not know. I said, what did you mean when you were writing this poem? I found that they were utterly devoid of wisdom because all they do is cleverly string together words that sound phonetically beautiful together. See what I mean? But they have no wisdom as to the meaning. This much disturbed me, he said. So after unfortunately what happened was, you would think that when I went to the poets and exposed to them that they were not wise, you would think that they would be happy with me and say, thank you for showing me that. He says, but it wasn't that way. And he's totally serious now. He says, and he goes, it wasn't that way. You know what happened? They got angry at me. They said, you're a troublemaker. You're a talebearer. You cause problems everywhere you go. And I said, listen, all I'm doing is trying to find out what God told me to do. Next, I went to the politicians. Now, the politicians are the leaders. These are men that we put in office. We elect these people, and they speak for us. And so I went to them, and I asked them questions about wisdom, and I was completely dismayed because you know what I found out? They did not have wisdom. You know what? He goes, because they knew about some things, they supposed that they were wise about all things. And he goes, and they looked utterly foolish. You know what it's like? When I read that, this is the illustration I use with the seniors. You ever see these guys like Robert Redford comes on, and he says, you know... my smile is very important to me, and that's why I use Ultra Bright, or whatever, or I use Crest. Like, big deal. Robert Redford, what does he know about toothpaste? He's a person just like you. He's an actor. But here we are in America, and we think that because Robert Redford is a celebrity that he knows something we don't know about toothpaste. He doesn't. They're filling his pocket with money. Robert Redford knows nothing about let me tell you something. You use Ultra Bright, or you use Pepsodent, or you use... Your teeth are going to be just as clean. I mean, today I think they pretty much got them all down to a science, right? But they get the celebrity up there, and what? Because they are wise in some things, acting, they suppose they are wise in many things. So Socrates makes some good points there. Then he goes, I'm dismayed at this point. God, you said I'm the wisest man in the world. I don't get it. Then I went to the craftsmen, and I found that the craftsmen were the wisest of all. Because the craftsmen, at least... learned how to do something. The man who made flutes knew how to bore out the flute and how to space the holes to make a sound. And through training and through instruction and through years of tradition, they learned a craft, so they had wisdom in a thing. They could do something and be... But you know what? They made the same bloody mistake. they supposed it because they could make a flute that they knew about politics. And they supposed it because they made a flute that they knew about toothpaste. And he says, the problem is, I found it, because they thought they were wise and they were not wise at all. And then, epiphany. You know epiphany in literature, what epiphany is? That's the point in the story where all of a sudden the character goes, aha, now I get it. James Joyce came up with that term in Ulysses, that crazy book that he wrote that's all symbolic. But he came up with this term, epiphany, when the character goes, aha, the light bulb goes on all of a sudden, and he understands something that usually the reader's already been privy to because of the point of view that the writer is taking. Now watch this, okay? He says, all of a sudden, I realize what the God meant. I am the wisest man in the world. Because out of all the men in the world, I'm the only one who knows that I am not wise. He said, I am the only one who knows that I do not know everything. And he goes, everyone that I talk to thinks they're wise when they're not. But I have no pretensions. I know I am not wise. And I make no pretensions about it. And I've never said that I'm wise. Therefore, I love wisdom. I'm a philosopher. I love wisdom. Philosophos. The love of wisdom. I love wisdom. And I'm in the pursuit of wisdom. But I realize that above all men, I have no wisdom. And he said, this is what the god Apollo meant. Because I know that I have no wisdom, that is why I am the wisest man in all the world. And that was his argument. And you know what? You say, yeah, this guy's pretty clever. He's a bugger. He's a clever bugger. And so, what else can we say about Socrates? Oh, we could say a lot. What else do we want to say about him, though? Oh, okay, Leah, let me put it up there for you. I'll leave it up during the break as well. Here's page 2. Okay. What else can we say about him very quickly? I'm not going to get into his philosophy about the good, the true, and the beautiful. You can study that on your own. It's in the notes. One thing I should say, though, there is a very... Xenophanes was a religious philosopher. And, you know, when he talked about the gods, one thing about the impiety thing, when he talked about the gods, he said, listen, you know what? He said, he goes, I was thinking about why the Greek gods are all men and women. He goes, and this is what I thought of. And this got him into all kinds of trouble. But he says, you know what? He said, if you asked a cow, did I ever tell you this? Oh, he says, if you asked a cow to draw God, you know what he'd do? He'd draw a cow. He said, and if you asked a mule to draw God, guess what he'd draw? He'd draw a mule. He goes, so is it any wonder that our gods all look like men and women? So, you know, this is the time in Athens. Let me just explain to you a little bit historically about what's happening now, just so that we'll close this section up and then we'll come back with Plato, who is not as much fun, but very, very fascinating what he believed. Okay. A series of wars had just ended known as the Peloponnesian Wars. The Peloponnesian Wars we'll study later, but the Peloponnesian, what we'll mention later, were wars between Athens and Greece, Athens and Sparta. Sparta and Athens went to war. And Athens lost because the jugheads didn't lose in battle very much. They weren't real good thinkers, but they sure could fight. The hoplites, the Greek hoplites, soldiers, they were absolutely, they had these, I ought to bring this book in. I bought this book at the book warehouse this week. $7. I could not believe it. It is this big. It's a big oversized hardcover book that goes through every major battle ever fought in the history of the world with beautiful pictures and everything, all the way back from the Sumerians up to Schwarzkopf. Unbelievable. There was one left there. It's like this thick. It's like this thick and big oversized book with lots of pictures and graphs and it tells you how they fought, the difference in armor, how weaponry evolved. Brilliant, great book. But anyway, the hoplites had, I ought to show you that picture, they had this big thing that stuck out of their head, the helmets like this, you know, the Greek hoplite soldiers, the helmet. And, okay. Anyway, they're in the middle of this war. After the war is done, what happens, folks, is the, as you know, Athens is a democracy, and the democracy is overtaken. And it's overtaken by what is known as the Council of 30, or the 30 Tyrants. And this is a board that basically executes everyone that disagrees with them. They're like a dictatorship, okay? And here's the problem. Ready for this, ladies and gentlemen? One of the guys who is the leader of the... what is his name? One of the guys who is the leader of the 30 Tyrants is... I got to get you his name. Hold on just a second. Critias. One of the guys who is the leader of the 30 Tyrants, Critias, was a disciple of Socrates. Did you hear that? Listen carefully. One of the guys who was a disciple of Socrates was the leader of this band of tyrants that come in and overtake the democracy, okay? After a few years, the democracy is restored, and everybody is pardoned who had anything to do with the Council of 30, okay? You following me? However, now all of a sudden, Socrates is drawn up before the trial, and he's accused of impiety and corrupting the youth. Two pretty bogus charges. And there are many who believe that the real reason that Socrates was brought before the court is because of his association with Critias. They couldn't accuse him of anything that had to do with the 30 tyrants because they've been pardoned. You see what I mean? So they had to get some trumped up bogus charges in order to bring him down. You see what I mean? How many understand what I mean? All right, if you're not confused at all. Okay, good, excellent. So that's what's happening. Now, one more thing and then I'm going to let you go. Let me tell you something about Plato. They think, Plato and Socrates, they think the poets are the biggest imbeciles who ever lived because they deal in fantasy. They deal in fantasy. The greatest knowledge that you can know, especially with Plato, more Plato than Socrates, but the greatest knowledge you can know, who can tell me what it is? The greatest, highest form of learning, knowledge. Anybody? Oh, come on, think back to last week. Pythagoras. Math. Abstract concepts of mathematics. When you've got to that, so they've got four levels now, and I'll show it to you when we come back. First of all, is the first level is the poets who deal with what? Fantasy, right? Shadows, fantasy, shadows of what really is. The second category of people are the craftsmen, because they have a higher form of knowledge because they can actually do something, okay? And then the third is minor theories, coming up with like theorizing and stuff like that, okay? A hypothesis, that kind of thing. And the fourth and the highest level of knowledge is mathematics. Understanding abstract concepts of mathematics. Okay? And listen, we're going to leave it there. Now we've just made the big step into Plato. Plato is much different than Socrates, and he is absolutely brilliant. I told you that when the scientific revolution happens in the 1500s, only two guys are going to be reborn from the ancient world. Pythagoras, because of his theory of numbers, and Plato. Plato is absolutely brilliant, and we'll see that when we come back from the break. Okay?